Hello and welcome to this emergency edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about a Trump Tower deal in Moscow, and he's agreed to cooperate with special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. So to clarify a little bit for anybody who's now seeing a second Mueller-themed podcast in the feed today, this morning, before this news broke, when we did not know that this was going to happen today, we put out an episode of what we were calling Mueller Talk, updating folks on new developments that took place during the first half of the week. Well, now we're in the second half of the week and there's more news, so we're back for an emergency podcast.
Is this a Mueller cast?
This is a Mueller cast, but it's also like an emergency Mueller cast.
Got it.
And here with me to talk about Michael Cohen's guilty plea are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going pretty well.
Good. Good.
I just wanted to be very low-key.
Not excited about Michael Cohen.
Just another plea deal. Just another day. Another plea deal.
Moving on. We have senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going?
It's going well.
All right. And, of course, we also have 538 contributor Amelia Thompson-DeVoe. Hey, Amelia. Long time no see.
I know. Second pod in 24 hours. This is great.
This is the content life we live.
Yes. Hashtag content. We closed this morning's podcast by asking whether the first half of the week was just pretty smoky or whether there was actual fire. We came to the conclusion that it had been a smoky week so far. However, there was no fire. You can use whatever rating system you want here, but Amelia, can you update us to where this week is now that Michael Cohen has said that he lied to Congress about this Moscow deal?
What happened this morning is that the president's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, showed up in a Manhattan courtroom and he pleaded guilty to making false statements to Congress. And this is actually his second surprise appearance in a Manhattan courtroom for a guilty plea in a couple months. You may remember that he pleaded guilty to a variety of federal crimes, including campaign finance violations back in August. But those charges were from a different set of prosecutors. This charge is from Mueller, so it's a big deal. And according to the formal charging document, Cohen lied to Congress about a real estate deal in Russia that we're calling the Trump Tower Moscow project. Everyone else calls it too. I don't know why I made it sound like we came up with that, but that's the basic story.
So, Amelia, how, to be very scientific here, how big of a deal is this?
Scientifically, it could be a very big deal. But I want to emphasize that, you know, there's still a lot we don't know. Obviously, anything that links, sort of concretely links people who are very close to Trump with Russia during the 2016 campaign is potentially a very big deal. This does not, of course, indicate that Cohen or others were coordinating with Russia to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. But because this is the first sort of direct link we've seen, it could mean that there are some other shoes to drop from Mueller that could also be a very big deal.
Okay. Well, we're doing an emergency podcast, so I assume that people think this is a meaningful development. Claire,
isn't that a little circular, though?
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't that beg the question? Is that the correct use of beg the question?
Why are we here?
So I have some, I mean, I do have some, I'm a curiosity seeker in what all this means. And Amelia, I think you know a lot more than probably a lot of us here. So what seems to be the implication to me here is more that Trump had perhaps undisclosed business dealings with Russia. Perhaps that's a conflict of interest with like foreign powers influence, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the Russians were colluding to help him win the election, right? That's kind of what people are dancing around, is that, you know, he had these business interests in Russia. Perhaps he was hearing from foreign dignitaries or people of influence in Russia they shouldn't have been. But it doesn't necessarily follow that if he has these business interests that they would be helping him, including to help him win the presidential election, right?
I think that's right, Claire. And I mean, what's sort of more interesting to me, and Galen and I talked about this a bit on the other podcast that just dropped this morning, but Mueller has sort of been issuing these indictments, and there's now today's charging document that are sort of shedding light on a bunch of different things. And so, I mean, I think this is also just significant in that it confirms something, you know, that this had actually been reported by a couple of news outlets that Trump and the Trump businesses had actually been working on this Trump Tower Moscow deal longer than they said they had. So the sort of the timeline is that Michael Cohen had said, you know, no, we kind of wrapped all of this up before the Iowa caucuses in January, around the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, this didn't really spill over into the time when Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee. And actually, it went on several months into the year to June, when everyone sort of knew that, you know, Trump was going to be the nominee. And so, I mean, yes, there's no evidence at this point that this means that the Russians were helping Trump or the Trump campaign or people in Trump's orbit and coordinating to influence the election. But this particular deal has sort of been scrutinized as a possible point of connection between Trump and Trump World and high-level Russian officials. And this charging document certainly reinforces the potential importance of this deal as a place where people who were close to Trump were connecting with the Russians. So that's why I think it's significant.
Trump already laid out his defense to reporters this morning. He talked to reporters on his way to the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, and he said that Cohen is lying to get a lighter sentence, and that on top of that, even if Cohen weren't lying, that this would all be fine. He continued his business as he was doing. If he had lost, he would have just gone back to being a businessman, so it's not unreasonable for him to just continue
business as usual. He's a businessman.
With Russia. So first of all, is Trump correct that it would be totally fine for him to continue doing business with Russia as presumptive nominee for president of the United States?
I can't think of a kind of legal violation. It's a good question, though. Certainly politically, it has more weight. I mean, again, I see this more as sort of a building block than something that is going to hurt the president directly. I mean, one of the things that's very significant about this is that Cohen is cooperating. His plea agreement says that he's cooperating with Mueller. And there's been reporting, and this also seems to just be evident from the fact that he got this plea deal, that he's providing information that's been useful to Mueller. And so what that is, we don't know. But that's the big question mark, is what is Cohen potentially telling Mueller that is maybe unrelated to what's in this charging document?
All right, Nate, you've been quiet over here. What do you make of all of this?
Have I been quiet, or was I not asked questions? Was I not asked to contribute?
I gave you an opening to say how big of a deal scientifically you thought this was in the
beginning. Nate's feelings over here.
Okay, Nate, you've been ignored for far too long. spill it.
You would think I would have a good answer after all that buildup. No, look, it goes to motive. It goes to the fact that here is why Trump would have dealings with Russia potentially. It's one implication. The other one is, like, to the extent it's a matter of Cohen's word against the president's word, well, I don't know if that's going to be convincing to people looking at impeachment or other sanctions against Trump. But Cohen can also help Mueller to uncover evidence of all of this. And presumably it's not just going to be a he said, he said kind of thing. And so the fact that, unlike Manafort, Cohen seems to be inclined to cooperate and has said things about the president that are not very kind already, and like can like leave a lot of breadcrumbs for Mueller to chase down.
Yeah, Cohen doesn't seem to be angling for a pardon to me.
No, it is weird. I mean, that is interesting, right? I don't know if you folks talked about it this morning, but like I assume that is Manafort's strategy, is he assumes that he'll get a pardon. I don't know, right?
It was either that or he was afraid of possibly being assassinated.
Can I read an Andrea
Bernstein?
Or
that he's just stupid. I mean, that's another one that he just thought he could outsmart Mueller, and it turned out he couldn't. Sorry, what were you going to say, Claire?
Yeah, let me just read an Andrea Bernstein tweet that just came across my transom. She is, if you guys don't know or listen to the podcast, one of the hosts of Trump Inc. from WNYC, and it's very good. It's about Trump's business dealings. And she says, what's significant about today's plea? It involves Trump, Russia, and business and the campaign. Cohen, one, spoke to Kremlin official about a Trump-Moscow deal. Two, spoke of it more than three times to Trump and members of his family. 3, kept a, quote, senior campaign official, end quote, in the loop. 4, covered it up. So I think that's a pretty good synopsis of what the inconsistencies were and where people are kind of pointing to this sort of smushing together of Trump's business and Trump's campaign. And I do think that that seems to be, you know, when we talk about, you know, was it legal for Trump to keep running his business while he was campaigning? I mean, yeah, I would say yes. I'm not a campaign finance lawyer, but I think it goes to the idea that he never released his taxes. He broke a lot of the rules about transparency, or the unspoken rules that about transparency that presidential candidates have. You know, we don't know anything about his current financial situation or dealings, so it could get to the idea of what are President Trump's entangling business interests, if any, with a foreign power.
And going to Andrea's point about covering it up, right. If you believe Michael Cohen, that means that Trump knew that Michael Cohen lied to Congress about the business dealings and didn't say anything.
So yeah, oh yeah, Cohen perjured himself.
It means that Cohen perjured himself. Trump knew it and didn't correct the record, even though he was intimately acquainted with his own business dealings.
Right.
And the other potentially significant thing here is that Trump just submitted his written responses to questions from Mueller last week. And there have been reports that in those questions were queries about the Trump Tower Moscow deal. And so now there's a question of, you know, what happens if what Trump said in his written responses contradicts Michael Cohen? I mean, he, you know, presumably sort of couched this in language that would give him some plausible deniability if there's a discrepancy between other testimony that Mueller has and these written responses. But, I mean, you know, it seems pretty clear why Mueller wanted to wait to drop this until after he had the written responses from the president in hand.
Yeah.
So is Mueller trying to trap Trump?
Or is trying to trap him. I think he's just trying to get the responses from Trump.
The whole take-home test format of Trump's questionnaire has always been interesting to me, right? Because in previous presidencies, Clinton was deposed.
Open book.
He's Googling.
Yeah, no, but seriously, he is Googling stuff. I mean,
well, also, obviously, his lawyers played a very big role in typing out the answers or coming to some conclusion of what answers Trump should type
Trump
out.
Trump doesn't use computers. But yeah, I mean, I've always found that to be an interesting thing. I don't know if we can call it entrapment so much as perhaps Mueller is good at strategically rolling things out. I mean, I myself, as someone who it's not my main job to follow this stuff, like, do sometimes find, okay, well, what was two indictments ago? Or what was two spurts of Mueller news ago? And I saw today some people saying, well, maybe there's never going to be like this single document at the end of everything that ties everything up together. Maybe it's just going to be those drips and drabs things. I'm wondering what you guys think about that.
I mean, Mueller does, he has to write some kind of report under DOJ regulations where he basically has to, at the bare minimum, outline to his boss, who is now Matthew Whitaker, why he chose to indict some people and not others. It is totally plausible, and I think quite likely, that we will never see that report and that there will not be, you know, I think people are kind of used to thinking about, you know, like the Starr report, which was, you know, went into enormous detail, kind of like read like a, you know, like a juicy novel. We're very unlikely to see something like that. You know, I do think it's interesting that even in this charging document, which was pretty short, Mueller is telling this sort of quite compelling story about, you know, how Cohen lied about all of these events. And these are the events that happened, and this is how, you know, they tried to cover it up, allegedly. And so, you know, I do think it is interesting to think about every Mueller document as sort of not just these are the legal charges, but, you know, these are the things that he knows are going out into the public discourse, into the public conversation. When all of us, whenever we're talking about this investigation, you know, I feel like I have to caveat everything by saying we don't know. We don't know what's going on in this investigation because so much of it is secret, and we're really going to only know, you know, this is only going to make sense looking backwards. So yeah. I think that is a good way to think about anything that we do get from Mueller.
I've increasingly started to think that the best job in Washington must be spokesperson for Robert Mueller, because they always have no comment and they're constantly called upon. So it's like, you got all that prestige, but you don't have to do any work.
I know. In every report, it was Mueller's special counsel's office declined to comment, except the one
time. No, it's always a spokesperson, too. I'm like, who is this spokesperson?
All the DOJ spokespeople fight over who gets to.
Yeah, just like sitting in an empty room by a phone.
I can imagine just like picking up phones being like, no comment. No comment. No comment.
Is it like a group of people just all eating lunch saying no comment? Okay. Anyway, this is the politics podcast. So before we wrap up, let's get a little bit into the politics
political.
Of all of this. It has been about 2 months that Mueller has been quiet. Has that, Nate, helped Trump in any way that the Russian investigation has taken a backseat?
I mean, he just lost 40 seats at the midterms. I mean, if you look at the approval rating, then he's at 42.4%, although higher, we should say, in Rasmussen reports. So in an alternate reality where Rasmussen reports lives, I'm going on a tangent. He's at 42.4%, which is actually sort of high on relative to his range historically. You know, it had dipped down to about 40% back in early September when you began to have more news about Cohen and Manafort. And so I don't know. You know, I tend to think that, like, this type of news won't affect him directly. It's more building the case and the background story for it. But, like, look, we're in a different environment now in the sense that, number one, Democrats control the House. And number two, Republicans who know anything know that Trump actually does not walk on water, that a president with a 42% approval rating is going to have trouble, for example, holding swing seats in the House and, for that matter, maybe holding swing states. And so you're going to see behavior potentially from Republicans where they're not willing to give him the benefit of the doubt as much. With that said, you also had a midterm in which things were very polarized, and places that voted for Trump by 10 or more points, which is quite a few actually states, supported Trump and Republicans again in the midterm. And so, you know, and so, like, if there were a bunch of, I feel like I'm contradicting myself, you know, if there were a bunch of, like, swing state senators, they would be an interesting group to watch. You know, Cory Gardner now, so we're turning 2020. Cory Gardner in Colorado is arguably the most vulnerable Republican incumbent senator. Colorado has become not just purple, a little bit bluish right now, and he's pretty conservative. You know, will he begin to change his vocabulary at all about Trump? Will Susan Collins in Maine, will Joni Ernst in Iowa, although Iowa's fairly red at this point? That's a group to watch.
And with the idea being that if that group of senators becomes more skeptical of Trump, that could affect also public perception of Trump?
I mean, typically, yeah, it's a little bit like you never know kind of what the cart is and what the horse is. But typically, when people within the Republican Party who are party leaders or thought leaders begin to turn away from the president, then that would give other Republicans permission to turn away. And if Trump's approval rating goes from whatever it is, 87% among Republicans to, say, 75%, that's still good. But, like, that's at a point where he would be in, like, the mid-30s among all voters. And then that becomes, like, very, very difficult. It is, by the way, interesting to me. Can I make just a random comment?
Make that random comment.
It's interesting in some sense how you've heard less about impeachment than maybe I would have thought. Like, if you had asked me, I think I probably said this on the podcast at some point, like a year ago, right? I think I probably said, oh, if Democrats win the House by a big margin, and 40 seats is a big margin, then for sure they'll want to impeach Trump. You know, it is interesting now where, like, it feels all of a sudden like 2020 is just around the corner, and you don't hear that as much from Democrats. And I think maybe part of the reason why in the back of their head is like, hey, we don't have to impeach him because we can beat him in 2020. I don't know if there are, like, discussions about that explicitly, but, you know, hey, for my money anyway, you know, that's what elections are for, is to have referendums on presidents and their conduct and whatever else. And so, but there's been less impeachment talk than I thought. And so I'm also interested in not just how Republicans react, but what happens when, you know, again, to me, this is not like a 5-alarm bombshell. It's like a 1 or 2-alarm bombshell. When the first kind of 4 or 5-alarm bombshell drops, or like the Mueller report drops, or there are rumors and innuendo about it, then do we begin to hear the impeachment word again? Because Democrats didn't talk about it much during the campaign, haven't talked about much about it since, but, like, that's a very pertinent question. The entire end game here is, like, that's the remedy, is either he gets voted out of office or he gets impeached. And, you know, and we haven't heard very much about one of those.
This is actually a topic that came up with Nancy Pelosi during her campaign to be elected Speaker of the House. In that New York Times profile, Claire, we've talked about it, she says, you know, I don't think pushing for impeachment right now is a good policy. And if it's appropriate to push for impeachment, that's probably going to mean that Republicans are interested in impeachment, too. So she's basically put herself in a situation where she's not necessarily calling for impeachment unless there's something that has Republicans that upset that they would also call for impeachment.
Which I think is a safe and probably good strategy for starting off a congressional term in which a lot of your Democratic caucus has won in states that are traditionally Republican that might be not skeptical of the Mueller investigation, I would say, but skeptical of premature plunging the nation even further into partisanship, which, like, let's be honest, that is what impeachment would do, right? That is the danger. And I think let's take the I guess, I don't know how to say, the best faith assumption of why politicians are sort of trying to stave off impeachment. I mean, some of it, I think, is like political viability. But I do think there's a, you know, people look back over their shoulders and say, man, the Clinton impeachment was so divisive and we weren't as divided from a partisan point of view as we are in 2018. I think impeachment in America in the next 2 years would look really nasty. And so I think that that's at least something that people are considering.
But remember, Clinton impeachment was in his second term. And yeah. Nixon's impeachment was in his second term. And so if you have a second term president, then there's no more remedy if they're a lame duck, right? And so, you know, so it is like, hypothetically, if like some bombshell news dropped in like June of 2020, would Democrats say, let's impeach him now, right? Or would Republicans, I mean, what would happen? I don't know. But, you know.
Well, only time and future episodes of Mueller Talk will tell. But we will leave it there for now. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Galen.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
And Amelia, thank you. It's been fun. We got to spend a bunch of time together over the past 24 hours.
It's been great. Thank you, Robert Mueller.
And a reminder that if you are looking for an update on other Mueller news from the week, including Manafort and Jerome Corsi, who, if you don't know that name, you should listen to the podcast so you can find out. Very colorful character. Anyway, that's on the next podcast in this feed. I'm Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Thanks a bunch for listening, and we will see you soon.